Just before we get started, the Second Act Podcast would like to acknowledge that we are recording this podcast on Treaty 7 land inhabited by the Blackfoot Nations. This includes the Siksika, Piikani, and Kainai. We would also like to acknowledge the Tsuut'ina and Stoney Nakoda First Nations, as well as the Métis Nations and all people who make their home on Treaty 7 land in southern Alberta. But now that we've paid respects to people that were here before us, let's start the pod.
Welcome to the Second Act Podcast. Today, you'll notice that we don't have Liam on. Schedules conflicting at the end of the school year. Work for me. It's baseball for him. Tests, different things dictated that Liam couldn't be with us for this one. And that's okay because this is a different and unique one. This is the first podcast where I've actually interjected some breaks in it and interjected my own thoughts. Today's guest, Kara Fogwell. She has a really unique story. She talks about some really raw things that have happened in her life. And during our discussion, there was just so many spots where when there was pauses for breaks, it wasn't something that I felt like it was the right spot for me to interject. She was very much on point and knew what she wanted to talk about. So I just let her talk. So the first half of it or so, there's really not a lot of conversation. Kara just talks. And then we kind of get through her early life and some of the abuse and stuff that she suffered. And we start talking about her second act, which is a wellness community in Powell River, BC, that she's working on with her sister-in-law to get people who need help and need support to that support and help, and how she talks about how the things that go into that life and what she does. And I haven't had a podcast like this. This was a unique one for me. I've been sitting on it for about 3 weeks because I wasn't quite sure how to present it. And I found it to be, every time I listen to it, which is easily, I've listened to this one 3 times more than I normally would. There was something new and different and I had to leave that part in, and I couldn't interject there. And there was a couple of times where I just interjected to point something out, something that I wanted to make sure that wasn't lost. But by and large, this is Kara's story in Kara's words. So without any further ado, let's turn it over to Kara Fogwell.
Hi, thanks, Gord.
Are you, you're out in Powell River, BC right now.
Yes, I'm in Powell River, British Columbia. It's on, you go north on the coast from Vancouver. It was my husband, Paul Mary, the Huntfish Maniac, and yep, country music star who was on your show a little while back. And I thought it was pretty interesting what you're trying to do by providing people with stories about success and change and finding personal, meaningful work to do in their lives is kind of what I like to do, change-based sort of work, and what I do for a living. So it was kind of a very interesting concept, your podcast. That's when I said something. I was like, oh, that's kind of what I did too. Finding sort of the right place out there in the world with a career that I've been forming for a while. So.
Well, and it's I guess commendable that you thought like that, because there is some stuff, in your past that you kind of need to confront to make what you're doing today that much more meaningful, and that change being that remarkable. Why don't you give us a little context on who you were as you were growing up and led you to some of those decisions?
Sure. I had a pretty nice, happy childhood in a lot of ways. My father's a minister, my mother's a teacher. I guess that was an interesting combination. But pretty safe, nice childhood in a lot of ways. I struggled a lot with different things in the church growing up, just different sort of pieces that didn't make sense to me. And so I ventured away from there, trying to find my place in the world. And I experienced what I now know. I'm a clinical counselor and a registered social worker. And I think I had some pretty bad anxiety as a child. I had a lot of phobias of pretty much everything. They're pretty extreme and got in the way of a lot of things at that time. And then when I was a teenager, I definitely experienced more depression. A lot of it really related to just kind of this really backwards, depressing, upsetting sort of world. And I guess as youth, you're first confronted with that when maybe if you grew up in a home that was, and maybe you were a little protected from those things, you don't necessarily know what to do when you're confronted with, I don't know, friends making scary choices, sometimes the way, I don't know, the opposite sex talks to you, like just different things that were really unsettling to me. And so I definitely probably experienced some minor depression, which I mean, I think most teenagers do. And when I was introduced to substances and that, I just took a total nosedive. I was doing a lot of drugs. I was in the rave scene, just partying the night away and not really thinking about how unhealthy that was for me or for my brain or for where I was at developmentally. And met lots of still long lasting friends at the time, but also ran into some not so great relationships too. Yeah, it's really scary. I actually have two teenagers currently who are exploring these sorts of similar decisions, and I'm absolutely terrified.
Kara talks about a lot of things that aren't really unique to kids growing up, you know, that feeling of insecurity and having all those unknowns in your life. It's really unique as we get talking further into your story about how she reacted to this and the way that she always remained fully aware, able to recall it even to this point, some of the things that she was experiencing at that time.
I thought I could maybe help them, but I am just terrified with them. Anyways, different approach than my parents, definitely really talking a lot about what they're going through and I don't know, just trying to navigate it every single day. Yeah, so that was happening and I fell in love in the middle of the substance fog. Yeah, and so I ended up at the time I'd always worked. I always worked with people. I love people. I've loved kids for a long time, ever since I was a young kid. I've always thought, maybe similar to my father, that I had a future working with people in a helping field of some kind, not as a minister, but I liked people. And so I always landed jobs doing that kind of thing. And I was working in a group home at the time, working with kids with different developmental differences. And I didn't take that at school. I got a college diploma working in jails, which was a very strange experience. I don't think I spoke to you about that one.
No, that's new.
Although working there, I really solidified that I was not going to be in working in corrections, because I felt like I was, you know, policing perhaps more, and I wanted to be on the other end, more rehab, like helping right. people with different things. So that was just not the greatest fit. But I mean, I learned a lot about who I am as a professional. But while I was working in this group home and I don't know, not sleeping 3-4 nights a week or just like not good, I happened to meet a young person who was on the autism spectrum, and he was really suffering. He was also nonverbal and he was diagnosed as being profoundly deaf. He was 8 years old. And first time I met him, you know, he was violent in ways, a lot of hitting and biting and pinching. And it was really awful experience. And I was ready to quit this job because I thought that was absolutely insane. But when I spoke to my boss, but I also thought I wanted to sort of understand why is this little adorable person so upset, you know, like what, you know, and try to help him, because that's, I guess, it's a kind of a part of what was always making me tick. Anyways, I decided to continue working with him with some more support. This little boy who I worked with, I was able to continue working with him and with the right support, and able to develop a really profound relationship with a person who couldn't even speak. And at the time I was going through a first breakup with a serious person and all the other crazy things that were happening in my life. And he was a real source of stability, of meaning, sort of a place to connect with a part of myself that wasn't present in the rest of my life at all. You know, with that sort of meaningful stuff and I don't know, just having relationships that are really important. And so I decided I was going to go back to school, and I always knew I wanted to go do university and that I could do university, but I was just never in a place where I was ready to do it. So I decided to go into social work, and that was great. This was kind of like, oh, I think, you know, maybe there's some motivation to get my life back on track here, which is such an incredible thing to experience with this little person, totally shaping part of a core value that I have that really respects the diversity of humanity. So we all come with different sorts of gifts, different diverse things that we can give the world. And this person who maybe it's not so obvious to people, I'm sure if you're someone who's worked with people with different developmental differences, that you know the gifts that they have to offer. But this young person, you know, was able to connect with me in a way nobody else had for a long time, and really speak to who I was. And I, a gift that I'm eternally grateful for, because it has totally changed the course of my life. And so I went to school, but it was really hard, you know, trying to now arrange my partying and addiction style of life around trying to get a university degree. That was complicated. And I met another person at that time, started a relationship with a man who was also involved in a lot of drug use and substance use. We decided that we were going to move to the West Coast. I was moving to the West Coast because I was going to save my life and stop and just get it on track. Finally, quit all the drugs. There was drinking involved too, but it was mainly drugs. I'm just going to get out there. We're going to sober up. I got into University of Manitoba, which is an online program. So when we moved, this was sort of a shock to my partner that I was no longer interested in this lifestyle. And he certainly was. And that's some of the people we started to meet out here. And I didn't want to be involved in that. So that was just a real shock. And I had moved so far away from everything that I had kind of, you know, set up for myself and my family. I wasn't living near them at the time in Windsor, but I'm still just moving that far away. And I think I was living here for about a month. And I had my first significant episode of depression. I came out of nowhere. I suspect now that it was related to the ill health of the relationship that I was in, which turned to be shifted to being more abusive and controlling and different things. We were going on different paths, and I'm sure that wasn't comfortable for him. So that had started happening, and I couldn't get a job right away because everybody on the West Coast moves like way slower, even though they need lots of people to work. And it was like, I gave my resume everywhere. Everybody seemed to need to hire somebody, but nobody was calling me. So I was very impatient. And at the same time, I didn't share this with you either. I had a young boy I used to work with, not the one I was just talking about, but another young person who couldn't walk, so they're in a wheelchair. They didn't speak either, and I used to tuck him into bed every night. He was older, but smaller in size, and we spent a lot of time together, and he passed away about a week after I got there. So I had that happen. So I was just in the midst of this adjustment in life, and so many things didn't feel safe, and I triggered a part of me. Oh, also, I'm pretty sure in quitting substances pretty abruptly. At the time, it was a lot of cocaine primarily, but I would do anything probably, lots of different things. I think there was a lot of dysregulation happening for me in my nervous system. And I had some significant anxiety, which I'd never experienced like that, settle in, just sort of this uncontrolled thinking, lots of intrusive thoughts about really crazy things, images that I couldn't explain, basically tormenting my brain. And it kind of came out of left field. I didn't see it coming. And it was very scary, and I couldn't make them stop. And very soon I was into clinical depression, and I wouldn't have even had a concept at the time of what that was. And I wanted to die because I couldn't possibly live thinking the awful things that I was. And I called my mom because I didn't know what else to do. And she told me to go to the doctor. And so I did. And that was a nice encounter. I met a doctor who reassured me that these things happen to people. He said there's lots of ways to treat it. Sent the referral into a psychiatrist, gave me some medication. Medication was very helpful, very quick. Took me forever, of course, to get into psychiatry, probably a couple months, and a counselor, which by that time I was feeling a lot more like myself again, but never would feel like myself again because it changes you. And yeah, maybe you're probably different when you're 26 anyways.
Yeah.
You know, you're changing anyways. So that was a really crazy experience, and I managed it a lot myself. The doctor was helpful, and I thought it would never happen again. At the time when it happened, I had some very significant learning and thinking about how bizarre treatment for such incredible suffering was. Like, I felt my doctor, I can't even believe I got into a doctor so fast. That seems unlikely nowadays anyways, but I did. And it was a helpful experience, isn't always, but it was kind of like, here's some medicine. I'm like, oh my gosh, I pretty much want to die and think about it 24/7. I like,
yeah,
back to this crazy life I'm living right now with this person who is just not who I thought they were. And my whole life, it doesn't make sense. And like, and it was great. I had a doctor could listen. He said, you know, anytime you feel like really not good, you can come back, just come to the clinic, like really open. So that was great. But it was so, I knew in thinking about it after I was feeling better that when you feel that way, when you feel so unsafe, what you need is to feel safe, and you need somebody to, similar to the doctor, although I think in much greater capacity, to say, you know, you can land here. I can help you. We're going to figure this out. There's lots of options. Whatever happens, I'll be with you through this. Maybe even somewhere to go stay for a bit, you know, like, yeah. I guess like inpatient treatment, which is just impossible to get into in so many ways. It's usually a hospital visit if you have a mental health crisis for 5 days, and then you're sent back to life. Not always. They will definitely keep you there longer to keep you safe, but just like, it's like you need somewhere to go where someone's going to be with you until you sort that out. Like, it's a crisis. Like, oh, it's awful experience.
I think the most striking thing about talking to Kara about her life to this point is how clinical she describes so many things. And I think that's probably a function of the training that she's had and the work that she does now. But there is no denying that the clarity in which she recalls these things and the things that happened to her and how she's able to you know, connect those dots is an incredible feat of, you know, human brain engineering. Like, she's just got so much of this stuff on demand right there. And yes, it is a function of how she makes her living and what she does now, but also her brain just worked on that level throughout that whole period. And that, you know, as we hear, she did a lot of crazy things and her life was out of control, and she still had the wherewithal to recollect and understand all that stuff. I just think that's amazing.
So after that, I got a job here and I was working in disability services again, and I got a job at a local agency and loved my work again. I was doing university, loving it. That was all my professional life, always a significant, strong part in my life. Just always had so much meaning. It was great. Working my way through there, I had a child with my partner that I moved out west. Tricky scenario. I did eventually leave him. His addictions got worse and worse and worse. And it was really sad to watch, and also really psychologically bizarre to be in a relationship with somebody like that. And the addiction all ties into how they treat you and the way different things go. And trying to escape that was complicated. I ended up at a safe house a couple times. So, registered social worker working in a small community. It's a really small community. Yeah. Know all the professionals. The second time I'm at the women's safe house in our community, I realized the extent of how unsafe my relationship was, that I was in it. In fact, what could be called an abusive relationship. And so that I was able to really end it at that time, although there are wonderful services there too, but it's, I know, another example of, I don't know, the way we sort of, it's, you know, there's all these rules you have to follow when you're there, but you're a free person, but you're stuck there because you're trying to hide out from somebody. And I don't know, it was really difficult. I did have a friend who took me in and hid me out for a little bit until my ex had left to go see his parents for a little bit, which he was encouraged to do. But it didn't stop there with him, as I was still continuing to build the career. I was still trying to figure out how to stop the abuse or stop the just the relationship because it wasn't healthy and he was just getting worse and had to keep my child safe and so complex. And for a professional who was, I mean, working with parents in similar scenarios and just different jobs that I had, I was working at the time as well as a family preservation worker, it's called. So you work with families who are involved with child protection and supporting them with rebuilding relationships with their children or figuring out how to have the relationship while their kids are in care or adopted, things like that. So in the midst of all that, I was doing this work and I don't know, figuring it out myself. So it was very, I don't know, stressful. It was a very crazy time in my life, trying to just constantly think about how to keep my child safe and when he should be with his dad. And yeah, really tricky stuff. He eventually did leave where we live back to Ontario and didn't come back. And so that was a gift because I didn't have to worry about him sort of showing up unannounced, just the constant just harassment or different things that were happening just related to his inability to stop himself from doing things that he shouldn't do, that were inappropriate, were not safe, and even with our kid and stuff. So that was great. He moved. I thought, oh my gosh, this is, my life is finally going to start again. I had landed in a director position with the agency in town, overseeing all the child and family services. This was like life. I had started a new relationship. I was happy in it. I had my own house. I was going to be safe finally. And then when my partner at the time left to go away on a fishing trip, all of a sudden, I was having the crazy thoughts again, and I hadn't seen them in any way that felt unmanageable in like 7 years. I had not sought out any mental health treatment. I was like, that was something that just happened. Who knows? Wanted to forget about it. And the thoughts started coming in, and I was alone with my child, and they were unbearable. They were scary. They were awful. Something else saying them to me, not even my own thoughts, although I do not think that was my experience. And that led to the most significant depression I've ever experienced. If you're someone with chronic depression, recurrent depression, you will know that once you experience it, you have a higher chance of experiencing it again, because it's what happens when you feel so unsafe or you've burnt yourself out so much that the body, it shuts down as its next sort of mechanism to keep you safe or to recuperate or whatever it is, right? It's quite functional really in a lot of ways, but it's something that if happens to you once, you can likely have it happen again. I didn't know that at the time because I didn't experience very supportive psychiatry. But anyway, so here I was trying to take care of my kid by myself and I couldn't even do anything, sleep, eat, get out of bed. I did have some supportive friends around here and people who I'd made relationships with, and they came and stayed with me, but so bizarre. And eventually I was scared to tell my partner who was away, or I think actually, sorry, he was visiting his daughter at the time. He went on a fishing trip somewhere in this whole scenario too. And he had difficulty conceptualizing what was happening to me. I knew what was happening, but that is a really hard thing for
was he aware that this was a reoccurrence? Like, was he
plugged? He knew it had happened to me before.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
He definitely knew. He didn't end up in a, we weren't married at the time. That's when he had moved in with me. We'd been together for maybe a year, and he had moved in with me, but we weren't married. But he did know that was something from my past. Had never seen the likes of that, and was, it's scary, it's shocking.
Oh yeah, yeah.
It's how do you deal with it? And he wasn't around me when it happened, so I did that time protect him from it. Anyways, my mother came out and saved the day and flew me and my son back to Ontario, which is so hard. I think that would be, sometimes I have shared that experience with people who are in a clinical depression or have been clinically depressed. So sort of normalize or relate, like depression, yeah. I work with children. People come to me for parenting, different stuff, developmental assessments, different things that I do. And they could never wrap their head around the fact that I have been the parent who couldn't be a parent, that needed, you know, had I not had my mother, who I was able to convince to fly across the country and come fly me, because I couldn't get on a plane myself. I couldn't do this by myself. I could not get on an airplane with my son and fly, go anywhere. I needed someone to help me take care of him. And my primary concern was my son. I couldn't, oh, it's the most awful experience being a mother, or I would imagine being a father as well, in the midst of depression.
I think it's a really important time to take a step back and talk about what Kara was talking about there, because she was dealing with all that goes into that depressive episode, the feelings of inadequacy about being able to parent her child, and as she talked about, the perceptions in the community of this person who was helping people, you know, with these same problems in her day job, and how she kind of confronted that. And I think it's commendable that, again, through all of the issues that she was battling through, she was able to keep her head about her and manage that. I'm throughout this conversation, I was just astonished by how she managed to separate the two. It was just a recurring theme, and she seemed to always be able to have it in one hand, one side in one hand, and one side in the other.
So I recovered from that. That was a pretty long bout. And then I quit my job as a director, because at the time, after that experience, I remember when I was coming out of this depression, somehow realizing that I'm not like the rest of the world or something. That was my thought. I think I am quite a lot like the rest of the world now. But I remember thinking, okay, so I can't be happy all the time, or I can't be happy. Like, I'm happy. I don't even know if I really, like, I was angry about being depressed. And I remember thinking, well, if I can't be happy, then I'm just gonna make other people happy. Maybe that will, like, screw you, depression, or whatever else. And I remember this is right before I went for a jog. I always thought I could jog depression out of me, which does, you know, maybe help, and does help a lot of people, but never quite been the answer. But I remember thinking that, and then this started a little bit of fire in my head at the time, supporting people with developmental delay. I recognized a huge gap in our mental health system. There are many of them. We're trying very hard to fill all of those. The government, I would say, we've actively as a culture and society been trying to address this for a long time. But a lot of kids and their parents that I worked with had no access to mental health services. So if they have some sort of a disorder where their speech is different, or they, even for individuals on the autism spectrum, where they don't socially interact like other people, where there's these barriers, these perceived barriers to clinical counseling or psychiatry or seeing a psychologist, but really in that clinical counseling relationship, they couldn't get counselors. The public system felt ill-equipped a lot of the time to provide counseling for these individuals, even though these were kids whose, let's say, you know, they had fetal alcohol syndrome, so that was their disability, and they had been abandoned by their parent at some point, lost that relationship, and then were kicked out of school and also had a criminal record all of a sudden. And so they have all these difficulties, you know, they're 13 years old or something, 13, 14, and they can't see a counselor. Because in maybe it's this small community, or at the time, it trying to facilitate very specific clinical counseling approaches like cognitive behavioral therapy, right, which is really helpful, is not necessarily appropriate for somebody who thinks differently, right? So using those strategies perhaps might cause more harm. And so this is where this barrier would happen, and it would happen with adults too. Another example, an adult with developmental delay, but pretty good communication skills, higher functioning there, tried to attend the public anger management program because he had difficulty regulating with anger that was getting in the way of work. And he was an adult now working and just trying to interact with other people in the group. What wasn't appropriate in helping him in the way it's supposed to work, because he didn't have he has different ways of communicating and understanding. So that's the barrier that exists. And I thought, well, this is weird. Why can't these people get counseling? They experience just trauma after trauma, just being born and told you're different or dumber than your peers, not literally being told that, but just that, you know, you get put in this category and you know, they know.
Yeah.
Right. So that sparked a little bit of curiosity, you know, why can't they get, you know, how could I be a counselor to these individuals? Could I do this because I feel like I could provide change-based sort of work? Anyway, so I looked into clinical counseling and I found a program that was all online. It was great. So I started down that path again, thinking I'd never get depressed again. Like, sort of thought that was just, you know, because my ex had just the end of that whole scenario. But since that time, in different ways, I have experienced clinical depression again. The last time I experienced it was about 3 years ago. But what's interesting about that time, I had plugged along in my clinical counseling. It's a master's program. I had started working at a firm in town. I did my practicum there with a wonderful counselor, Rick Burghauser. And I had just stepped into actually working as a counselor, and a few different triggers related to my own trauma happened. And my partner was away again, and he makes me feel safe. That's usually something that's in the mix there. And here again, I saw it coming in heavy, and the insomnia, the different things I know. And there was something that happened that was very similar to my traumas with my ex. And I started going down that spiral. But about a year prior, when my grandfather passed away, I started, I'd always been interested in spiritual things. And I had researched. I love reading. I love learning. I'm just a total, I don't know, nerd or something. I don't know what. My husband calls me weird, but whatever, sure. But just always reading different spiritual kind of books, maybe some self-help, but also like actually reading spiritual texts from other religions, learning about Buddhism. I got into meditation probably about 10 years ago during my most significant depression because it was helpful, gave me something I could do, laying in bed, not being able to do anything. Anyways, oh, where was I with this? Yes. So I had ex experiencing this depression again, and about a year before that, I had re begun to look at the Christian faith again, with a bit of a new lens. My grandfather had passed away, and he was someone who regularly attended church. Didn't say much, but he was a bomber pilot in World War II. So what was said at his funeral that was just sort of opened me up. I had been always open to spiritual things, but difficult things with organized religion or the Christian church, particularly. And he said at this funeral, they talked about him having this foundation. That was one of the reasons why the trauma and the different things he experienced, he didn't impact him in a hugely negative way. And that they were referring to faith, right? In Jesus Christ and praying and different things like that. And they also talked about him and his long forest walks that he would do up at the cottage that we had in Muskoka in Ontario. And I was like, oh my gosh. And all of a sudden I was like, hey, I've done a lot of healing with different things that related to my depressions or different stuff, but I never worked my spiritual stuff out. So I started exploring that, and I redefined my faith, and I was back into praying a lot and believing in God and exploring this with a whole kind of new frame of mind. And I got depressed again. This time I had that. I had God. I had this more stability in that way. I'd had this during a previous depression when I didn't talk about, I did meet a psychiatrist who was helpful. Of course, it took me a long time to get in to see her, but I did. And she said to me, you know, I think, yes, you have recurrent depression, major depressive disorder. And she said, but I think you also have effects from trauma because I was having some real somatic issues with breathing. And I did some EMDR therapy, which was helpful. So I had some real help back then. But so through some of that healing, this time around, I knew what to do. And I was able to on no sleep for, I don't know, probably a long time or very little with my child. I had another child at that time now, a 3-year-old in tow down to the doctor to get all the medication and stock up. I was able to manage the depression that time on my own without having to call in a whole bunch of help. I did have people to help me out when I hadn't slept. I did have a supportive partner who was flying home from where he was more often. And even when Vegas trip in the middle of all this, that's if there's anybody who's been in a clinical depression or in recovery, Vegas is a very interesting place to visit at that time. But I promised somebody I was going there, so I did. Anyway, so I climbed out of that one on my own, and it was a real changing point, and rekindled my desire to explore. I mean, I don't know what the answer is for really effective mental health services. I know that safety is a huge key, but it really rekindled at that time. I felt like I had, and at that time too, I decided that I was going to take this medication that really helped me. It's so simple for me. Like many people have a much more difficult time finding medical help, that I was just going to take it until my kids can drive themselves. And I, whatever, like what, why do I keep going off this stuff? It's so helpful. So I kind of hit a new sort of solid ground and felt like, yeah, there, I got lots of stuff lined up. And so I wanted to re-explore, how is it that I offer, or how is it that I take now, does these credentials I've acquired, and start some sort of program, something to offer accessible mental health services. That was my thought. Now, I couldn't do this alone because I don't know how to run businesses. I'm a social worker, so I would never charge anybody money. But my partner's sister, so my sister-in-law, is a business major and also somebody who has a passion for, she's a caring, helping style kind of person. She's a teacher. And so I'd been trying to convince her to start a business with me after this depression. And I think she was kind of like, you know, I don't know about going into business with you. She helped me, you know, like she takes help with the kids and like, but also she just had a baby. So she kind of, maybe in a bit, we'll see. So three, like, and this is like, I don't know how, anyways, this is a couple years ago, cause we've been running this business. I had drawn out a couple times sort of business models or ideas and how you could make it a private practice, which I had zero experience in using social workers. I love the field of social work. It's really interesting how it works with external systems, internal stuff. Anyways, the idea of the business was everybody deserves to be well. So accessibility. And I did convince my sister-in-law. I told her she'd only have to work 5 hours a week on top of what she already did. I said, we're just like going to do some community groups, see if we can figure out how people can pay, because I have the right qualifications that insurance will fund it for people, but maybe we can get grants for people who can't, just trying to, and find out what the community needs. Just this big, like, I'm going to, I don't know, solve all the problems of the world kind of thing. And she was like, okay, let's try this. I kind of get the idea and I see how it could be a business. And so we launched it. They wouldn't accept our name. We had it, the Wellness Initiative. That's what I wanted to call it, because I don't like, this is an initiative. This is, we're trying to figure out how it is the private and public sectors can cross to be more accessible, because both of them have real inaccessibility points. And so it is a bit of a, it's a bit of a experiment. It's kind of like, let's see if we can do things different. Let's figure out how to really meet people's needs, and not just with mental health, taking a more holistic approach, right? Looking at all the different things that impact your health and well-being. Because when we're talking mental health, it's usually digging up why, you know, what is the deal? Why am I so scared? Why am I so sick? Why am I in so much pain? Why, you know, because really there's usually things going on that have led to that. So launched it, and we couldn't call it the Wellness Initiative. I don't know why. Something about it not being specific enough as a business name or something. I don't understand all of that, because my business partner, she does the business stuff, thank goodness, because yeah. I really don't care about business stuff, unfortunately. But I am learning the value of money. I'm learning how we can work with the systems that exist and make things work. But we've called it the VK for Vanessa and Kara, the VK Wellness Initiative, and it's become VK has become a bit of a thing, which is fun. After we launched our business, had no office, nothing, just from home, like we were just going to put it out there. And really, we were just advertising my private counseling practice at the time would be offered through there. And then it was wellness planning idea, which gives people the opportunity to, in 5 sessions, so not like 2 years worth of therapy, but in 5 sessions for less cost, come and hang out with somebody who's trained in, you know, interpersonal skills so that you can work with somebody on how you'd like to plan for your change, looking at all different experiences in your life and create a plan for it. Because I think counseling itself can be a little bit intimidating, a lot of stereotypes out there about it. So I just wanted a different program. So we launched these two things and we did some social media-ing, which I hadn't been on in like 3 years because I was terrified of my children using it because I don't know, I just take selfies all the time and I'm like, this is like, anyways, so we got back on there and after about 2 days of being on there, we were approached by the local municipality about asking us if we were interested in taking on, like working on a corporate project with them to support their occupational wellness of their employees. And that was a large organization of about 250 people, larger for our small community. So that was really interesting. And I thought, oh, and I had worked with this particular person in the past professionally, this human resources, the HR there. And we started this incredible, we did an assessment with the whole organization. And then from that, we were able to offer them recommendations related to occupational wellness and how to support the all of their employees who are working for them. And from there, it just flowed. It was incredible. We got to, because we asked the employee group what they needed and what they would access, right? And that's where we learned that the leadership team, specifically the people who are in leadership roles, were very, very interested in learning and they were asking for stuff. And so primarily they hired us just to do leadership workshops on different topics like communication and conflict resolution and emotional well-being and just different things, right? So we did this for a whole year and we did a couple groups for people not in leadership that were requested around resiliency and nutrition. It was fantastic. We got to get in there and meet, like, so the municipality is responsible for the fire department, so the firefighters, for people who work at the police department, for our parks and rec, like really cool to even just get in there and learn about how my city that I live in, how it runs, you know, and
yeah.
Fantastic people. Such a cool opportunity. Like it was so incredible. And at the same time, as we were putting ourselves out there and with this contract, we started having we have maybe 15 associates that work for us now. And we have an employee. We have somebody who does some administration and sits at the front desk a few days a week. So I approached one person when I saw they got their social work degree on Facebook and I used to work with her and was like, oh my gosh, come help me with these projects. And then after that, we had everyone who's come to ask about working for us, and it's in an interdisciplinary model. So like an integrated health model, body workers, social workers, a mediator. We have a clinical herbal therapist. We have a nutritionist, kinesiologist. We started attracting different professionals in the community that liked the business model, liked the accessibility idea, liked the fact that we were trying to offer services that took time to find out what the individual needed and what they wanted, right? So it was really cool to see this group of people now we have working together. They came to us and said, I think this is where I would like to work. I think I would like to figure out how to work here. And we offered them the flexibility of working 2 hours a week or, you know, I'd set up your practice here, right? So a bit of a different model when it came to employment. So that's where we're at. We also have some employee and family assistance program contracts now with the city that I live in. So with their organization, they're offering an EFAP program that is biopsychosocial in nature. So that means not just offering EFAP that's counseling if you need it, right? Yeah. But offering with VK Wellness. We have an intake process, so it's not necessarily just through us. We can help guide people to appropriate services outside of our organization as well, because we don't have everything, but social workers didn't usually know the resources that are available. So we have this EFAP contract, which has been what has really solidified us actually being able to be a successful business, because there's some significant funding that can come in from that. So yeah, plus there's so many other things we do too. It's not just that, but that's one of the big bigger success pieces.
The most striking thing that comes out of all that is how functional you remained through all of the trauma and chaos that was going on in your life. And I suppose that, you know, that served you well in the moment, but it never was a deterrent from it happening again, because you were always able to manage even when you weren't. Is that something that's just in your part of your constitution and the way you're made, or did you will yourself to do that?
Oh, I assure you, I have not been functional. But, and I say this to my clients a lot, you know, when people, I say, how are you coping? And everyone says, I'm not coping. And then I think, and like, not like you're not doing well, but how are you dealing with all of this? Right. I think maybe functional and unfunctional is fair, but also I think from being someone who's kind of gone through this, I feel like now, I'll cross my fingers. No, it's true. But now I feel like, I don't feel like I'm free of being depressed. I actually feel like I am a person who has major depressive disorder, and I do not have a day that I don't wake up. And I know that I eat, live, breathe, sleep, whatever you say, being a person with major depression. It is, but now it's like because I didn't commit suicide, and that has to do with that I had support. This is what you're asking. How do you function? How do you come back? Well, I did happen to have a family that I grew up in that did teach me. I know they must have, from what I understand about developmental psychology,
yeah,
that I was valuable. I did that. I, you know, that I was important, that, and they were able to show up for me when I needed, you know, when it was really, really desperate for sure. I don't think it's part of my constitution. I think it's simply part of being human and having the right support. I am a spiritual person, so I surely think that there is a God who I believe in that has carried me through for a very specific purpose. And most people who I walk along a healing journey with in clinical counseling or outside, that my work does definitely not stop at work. It happens in my regular life too. I surely think there is a larger power at play. Trying to get us to a better place as humans, to be honest. For those of you who would rather I talk about clinical things, I will just park that there. But that is surely something that has always been with me in the darkest of times, in the desperate cries. So I don't drive off the cliff, right? The desperate cries. That's not anything of this world that is carrying me through. That is this, something is there with you, helping you. I think resiliency is a good word. I think when you go through really difficult things, and humans have forever, since the dawn of time, been going through difficult things, if you can get to the other side, and if you can embrace, and if you can learn from it, and if you can figure out the way to manage whatever your stuff is, you can have a totally fulfilling life. Like, I would not, there are times in my life, there was a time when I would have changed depression and that really difficult relationship I went through, because it was totally a part of the trauma, right? Who, if I could take anything back, I would take those. But now that I've landed somewhere where it all kind of makes sense, and I'm in using it, perhaps, it's okay that it happened. And learning to not embrace, I don't even know if embrace is the right word, but to have compassion on yourself, because you're human, and because this is what happens to humans. And we live in a really, we live in a beautiful world, but we live in a world that has a lot of awful things going on, right? Like, we're killing our planet, you know, like you face it every day. So it's very likely, as a human, eventually it's going to get pretty overwhelming, and people cope with that in all kinds of different ways. Did that answer your question?
Well, yes and no. I mean, there's probably no answer to the question. It's just, when you talked about right from the beginning, it seemed to me like you were always forging ahead with one part of your life, striving, making gains.
Right.
But you had this part of you that at first you didn't understand, that you know was manifesting with, you know, acting out like young people do, and then drug abuse, and then the codependency with somebody who's not good for you. Like, all of those things are also fairly common, but always you were striving towards this other thing that you knew you had that. And it's remarkable to see how you kind of got to a point where those two things intersected, and you were in a position in your life to say, I'm going to go and do this. And I know how people on the other side of the table feel. Right. And I don't know if that makes it easier or harder. If you see yourself in some of these people and it sets you back one measurement of unit that day because you see that, or if it emboldens you and makes you feel stronger and prouder, or if you go home and hug your kids extra tighter, or how that works. Right. It seemed like throughout that whole story, you were always marching forward with something in your life. And I think that's commendable, so that when you get to the point where you're starting something new, it's like, this is what I've been working towards all along.
You know, it's interesting when you say that. First of all, you'd make a great clinical counselor. You just connected lots of dots, and I'm learning things about myself. And I knew that this process would do that inevitably. I got to tell you, most things go back to like kids for me. I worked in developmental services, specifically with babies, for a little bit as part of my career, who are at risk of developmental delay. And I got to learn all about how human development works and attachment and just this core piece. And you know what I think might be a huge resiliency factor for me is that from a very young age, and this goes like to my father, maybe, I remember I told you, I always knew I kind of wanted to be like that. There was this idea, and this doesn't necessarily just have to come from a Christian home. I think this could come from any home, this idea that life happens on purpose, that we have a purpose. We have things we can do like this. It's important, the decisions that we make, right? There's meaning behind this life, right? And how I was brought up, you know, thinking about how our actions affect other people and trying to be kind and trying to consider with intention, how am I going to deal with this person who's wronged me? Right. And the thought, you know, concepts like forgiveness, right. These sort of more, I don't know, socially responsible kind of ways of being or something, I think, and not, doesn't necessarily have to be the Christian home, but maybe that's it. This idea that there's this thing, like I have to, although I was very suicidal, then there was always this opposing factor in my mind that was like, but you haven't tried it. You haven't even checked yourself into like an institution ever. Like, you know, it was always like this piece that was kind of like, this isn't necessarily the end. You just keep on going. You got it. Maybe you'll sleep tomorrow night. Maybe you won't feel like this tomorrow. Like it's like there was this inner encouragement, I think there's a spiritual piece too, but I know that there must be something in there about the way my parents taught me about life. Not that happiness is the goal. Not that it was never that. This is not what I was taught. It was about who you are as a person is what like matters or something.
Yeah. And those, like, you know, the easy answers you don't have to look very hard for. Those hard answers are hard fought. And
yes,
you know, you fought and fought and fought and fought. And it's interesting that some of those things come back to something that was kind of there at the beginning. And you're just in a position where it wasn't as abundant or obvious, I should say, to you, you know.
But I think also, like, I think we're sometimes taught, especially in Western culture, like you kind of said this thing, like, how did you manage to persevere? How did you get through that? I think until very recently in human history, humans are incredible creatures. Like the stuff humans can live through or have. All right. And I think of like historically with women and like, just the stuff that maybe women, if they were raped a lot, or like there's these things that are different cultures going through, different like residential schools that's coming up now, the Holocaust, like humans survive and they're incredible survivors. Like humans have this thing in them, and it's not just me. It's every client that I work with. It's remarkable. There is something about humans that is incredibly special. It is incredibly strong. And if you can tap into that, and a lot of people tap into that they do through suffering. If there's anything out there around research, there is around suffering or different types of treatment that look at that, or more existential therapies or existential psychology. There is this idea that human suffering is actually inevitable, right? So just hang out with a 2-year-old for a day or two, you will see suffering, man. Those feel like it's the most violent creatures on earth do. Like Totally, right? Or teenagers kind of a little bit too, but suffering happens, right? Now, how do we show up for suffering? Maybe this is the human thing, right? It's this thing and the richness. If you are, I mean, the empathy, like if you go through suffering, the most empathic people, their stories are like, they're incredible.
We're an hour in here, and I do like to be respectful of your time. So I guess the one and every episode I end, I ask the person, what is success to you? What does it look like? Does it look different than you thought it was going to? And I feel like your story isn't as something as simple as do you feel successful? I feel like there's like a huge depending on what your goal was for that day, but how all the different emotions and things that have led you to this point are, success could be wildly varying. And I think it's like that for a lot of people. I just don't, I don't, I'm not thoughtful enough to ask the question that eloquently. But for you, on with the business, the VK initiative that we're talking about, what is the goal of that, and are you on that path with this right now, or is this something that we're working towards until we can get a clearer picture?
Well, the goal is that everyone has access to wellness, that everyone has access to being able to find what it is in their life that is going to provide them with well-being. That is the goal. And there's personal success measures, but I think you're talking about business success measures. And I think for myself, we are successful in where we're at with this. But what I would really, really like to see is that when somebody needs some sort of help, whatever that might be, whatever age that might be, whoever you are, that you can have somewhere to go, that you can have somebody to talk to, that you can get yourself, turn that corner, come up with that plan for the next day whenever you need it. And that is success to me. And I do think that we do our best at this time to do that. And even when the associates who work here are so incredible, there's a few more tougher, complicated scenarios with different families or different individuals. And I see people here who do this. They are showing up. They are figuring out. They are getting creative with their practice. They are, showing up outside of hours, going to people's houses, like just this different stuff. And so if every day at this, if VK Wellness is a place where people think that they can go there and they are going to find some sort of support, that's success.
Like I said at the beginning, this was a unique one, man. There was so much to unpack there, and Kara was so honest and open about her struggles and how the choices she made fed into the situation she was in. And I mentioned it a couple of times, but it just struck me how she kept marching forward in this crazy life that where things of her own volition and not were going on around her. And she kind of never lost sight of the goal, even if it was through the haze. And I was just floored by that, the way she spoke with such clarity and purpose about the things that she knew she had to do, whether she was always exactly in the right frame of mind or even physically able to do them or not. I just it was so remarkable to sit and listen to this woman talk about her life and the things that she was experiencing and wanted to go through. She was a tour de force, and it was incredible to take it all in. And I found myself acting like it was already recorded, and I couldn't interject. I had to just sit and listen because of the things that she was talking about. And then as it kind of came to fruition that, no, Gord, you're hosting this thing. This woman is live with you. I found that I just kind of didn't have the right words. This was one of the first times, in this podcasting situation where I was just blown away by someone's story to the point that I was just part of the audience, and I really wasn't taking my role as the host as seriously as I always had. I probably listened back to this one 5 or 6 times, just floored by the things that she was saying and with the clarity and the, just the way she talked about it. It was so incredible. Kara Fogwell, just an incredible guest, incredible story. And her VK Wellness that she's doing, it's such a lofty goal, lofty aspirations, and she's taken it on one foot in front of the other, one step at a time, like she's done everything her entire life. And I think that's just such a incredible story, such a unique and interesting way of going about these things, that as they break down in front of you, you just keep knocking one down and knocking one down. Incredible story. Huge thanks to her husband, Paul Marier, who we had on a half a dozen shows ago or so, the Hunt and Fish Maniac. He put me on to Kara, and we made it work. And it was just, you know, getting to talk to people like Paul and Kara and everybody in between are exactly why we do this. It's just, there's people out there, man, that you don't even know that have these stories. And it's so incredible to just think that, you know, people are walking around carrying this strength and this fortitude. And when you find somebody who's willing to share it like Kara, man, I hope you, if you listen to it all the way through, I hope you pass it along. I just think there's so much in here for people to take in. Another incredible episode. So happy to be able to bring stuff like this along to you guys. This is exactly why we started this podcast. This is like one of my favorite ones so far, for sure. So as we always say, there are no wrong answers. There's no test at the end. So make the most out of every day.
The Second Act podcast would like to thank Ben Sound for the intro and outro music, Happy Rock. That is www.bensound.com. We'd also like to thank Chin Whiskers for the promotional consideration. You can find them at your local Tommy Guns, Original Barbershop, Amazon, or chinwhiskers.ca. And we would also like to thank you for listening.
Test the microphone. No noise.